Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. House Democrats nominate Steve Shurtleff to be Speaker of the House. Democrats also hand Colin Van Ostern the vast majority of votes in the race for Secretary of State over Bill Gardner. And the New Hampshire ACLU files suit over the practice of emergency room boarding. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we'll talk about them in this hour. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Anna Brown of Citizens Count, Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Thank you very much, everybody, for being here.
Thanks for having us.
And welcome to, I guess, 5 months or 6 months maybe of snow and cold and terrible, terrible weather. I guess maybe not terrible if you're a skier or you like the outdoorsy stuff. Which I don't, but I guess that's a personal problem of mine. Anyway, happy shoveling, everybody. Hope your commute is going well. Give us a call if you have questions or comments about the week's news. Also want to point out that if you're not driving through the snow this morning and if you're near a computer somewhere, you can log on to Facebook and watch a video broadcast of the show. Just search for NHPR Exchange. That's all one word, and you can watch this radio show in progress. So we've got a lot of stuff to talk about today, and let's start with some of the most recent news, which is that House Democrats yesterday seemed ready to hand the gavel over to Steve Shurtleff as Speaker of the House. He defeated Rennie Cushing in a vote taken by House Democrats yesterday. So start with you, Kevin, on this. Sure. What do you think of the implications of this?
Well, I think this obviously wasn't what we're seeing in the U.S. House, where Nancy Pelosi is trying to return as Speaker. Steve Shurtleff is someone who's paid his dues, who's actually served as a top Democrat under a past House Speaker, Terry Norelli, who's no longer in the House. So I think he was certainly rewarded with that honor. But Rennie Cushing said there hadn't been a contest, and he's right, in almost nearly a decade for this job. So he thinks well of Shurtleff. Shurtleff thinks well of Cushing. I think Cushing will become part of Shurtleff's leadership team. Shurtleff won decisively, which is helpful to him, giving him strong support in his caucus, and the Democrats will unify behind him. And we're certainly going to see, as we saw last week with the Senate Democrats organizing, a very different approach and a very different agenda from this Democratic majority than we saw when Republicans held sway. Now the Democrats are going to campaign vigorously and hard for a mandatory Family and Medical Leave Act. They're going to campaign against the constitutional carry. In other words, the lack of any permit needed to carry a concealed gun, which was one of Governor Chris Sununu's signature achievements early on in his administration. Democrats will attempt to repeal that and probably face a veto from this governor.
Yeah, he's said he's going to resist any efforts on that recently. So, Anna, what do you think?
Well, I think that it shows a little bit, too, about what the priorities are going to be for Democrats going forward this year, because Rennie Cushing sort of presented himself as a progressive alternative in saying that he was going to push back a little more against the governor and make sure that the governor agendas wasn't overriding Democratic priorities. So he was looking at more progressive things such as, you know, marijuana legalization, death penalty repeal. So I do think the Democrats are going to look at, you know, more gun control. They're going to look at raising the minimum wage, but they're also going to be focusing on more bipartisan issues such as mental health care funding.
Mm-hmm. And Steve Shurtleff spoke recently about some of his top priorities from Paul.
One of the changes I talked about is legislation that will be introduced to create a position of HR director for the State House. No more having those issues of sexual and workplace harassment dealt with either the Speaker's office or the Senate President. They'll be done by professionals, by a bipartisan individual. We saw, as a result of the congressional election and the first CD, the issues we've had in the past with complaints about harassment, and we're going to deal with it in a professional manner. The other change of that legislation will, it'll be mandatory for all members to go through, of the House and Senate, to go through training and be aware of what the ramifications are in our policy, and they will sign off that they understand that policy and accept it. And for those that don't, there will be repercussions.
So this is sort of a response to lawmakers, some lawmakers' refusal to sign an acknowledgement of having received the sexual harassment policy at the State House, promising repercussions. Can he do that, Dean?
Well, I mean, I think he's certainly going to try to do it. And, you know, my sense on Steve is that he's been, you know, very open every step of the way about his desire to lead the caucus, even when it was in the minority. He's talked about wanting to be Speaker of the House on a number of occasions. I know there was among some progressives this discussion of, you know, Randy Cushing as a possible alternative, but I never really sensed that there was a serious opposition to Shurtleff eventually being the Speaker should the Democrats regain the majority. And they're going to have, I think, around 234 seats in the House for a majority. And, you know, the vote for Shurtleff was 183 to 42. We don't know yet who the majority leader is going to be. Obviously, Shurtleff has been a majority leader; he's been a minority leader. Some people have mentioned perhaps Rennie Cushing. Shurtleff has said there'll be a role for him in the leadership. I don't know exactly what that means yet, but I didn't find this result particularly surprising, given that Shurtleff has kind of openly been saying for a long time that this is something he wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. We're going to see with Shurtleff too. I think a level of administrative experience. Many people may not be aware. He's a career law enforcement individual. He served for almost a quarter century as deputy U.S. Marshal in the state of New Hampshire. And just so folks understand that position, the U.S. Marshal is a political appointee. Nick Willard, former Manchester police chief, got friendly with Donald Trump. He's now the U.S. Marshal. That's a real job. But the deputy U.S. Marshal is actually the career administrator of the office. So he has a lot of experience with thorny kind of issues like this, HR issues that occur in a workplace. And he's not only been uncomfortable with people failing to file forms here. We've had allegations of sexual harassment among both senior members of the state Senate and senior members of the House of Representatives in both parties. So this is an issue Shurtleff feels strongly about, and it's coming up from the membership. We need accountability here.
Mm-hmm. It will be interesting to see how that plays out. One of the things that was really interesting about the results yesterday is that Bill Gardner now seems to be in real trouble. He's been Secretary of State for more than four decades, but many Democrats who were unhappy with him backed his challenger, Colin Van Ostern, yesterday. The final vote was 179 for Van Ostern, 23 for Gardner, and 7 for Peter Sullivan. Anna Brown, what do you make of these results?
Well, I think that a lot of us were surprised that there were so many votes in favor of Bill Gardner. But I think it's important to remember that this is a non-binding vote and it didn't include any Republicans. So when it comes down to it, you're going to need a majority of the House and the Senate, which is 213 total. So 179 is about, you know, 30, 35 votes short of where you're going to need to be. And I think that it's probably unlikely that Republicans will get on board with Van Ostern. But I do think that it was a strong showing that, you know, the House wants the Secretary of State to be maybe less active in the legislature and in advocating for policies one way or another.
Mm-hmm. So do you think when the next round of voting occurs, the other Democrats will fall in line behind Van Ostern?
That's an interesting question.
Maybe hard to say.
I would say no. I think that Bill Gardner's probably going to come out on top.
Yeah, this is a commanding lead coming out of this caucus. And what happens now is, what a shock. This becomes partisan, which it hasn't been for, I've only covered 10 presidential primaries, and I know no other Secretary of State in New Hampshire other than Bill Gardner. So he's been a fixture in and kind of an apolitical fixture of people who know him. He is a Manchester Democrat, but he's not a political person, and he doesn't go to political parties like most secretaries of state all over the country. Doesn't go to fundraisers, doesn't go to rallies. Doesn't do any of that stuff, just runs elections. But as Anna pointed out, in the last several years, under Republican legislative leadership control, a lot of Democrats have felt he's been too cozy working with the leadership in passing legislation to tighten these domicile rules. So right out of the gate, Wayne McDonnell, Republican state chairman, says Van Ostern being Secretary of State is a significant threat to the First in the Nation primary.
Dean?
Yeah, this has been Colin Van Ostern's gamble all along. The idea was that he would form this Free and Fair New Hampshire nonprofit and work to try to get more Democrats elected to the state legislature, and that that might in turn bear some fruit for him in terms of the Secretary of State's office. That's been his. That's been the bet all along, and I think some people were probably surprised to see the extent to which he has moved in that direction. You know, Bill Gardner, for being an apolitical guy, has had increasing difficulty navigating a very polarized political environment. You know, Democrats are very unhappy with his, what some see as kind of tacit support of SB 3 and HB 1264, the voter, either voter registration or voter suppression, depending on your point of view. And Democrats feel that, as Kevin suggested, that he's been too supportive of that. The Trump Voter Integrity Commission, Gardner, I understand Gardner's argument was that he would participate in this commission to show that there's no voter fraud in New Hampshire. But as I've said many times before on this show, that commission was a sham. It was based on a fundamentally false premise that there were 3 million illegal votes for Hillary Clinton. And, you know, even by giving any kind of credence to that commission, which, as I predicted, fell apart quite quickly, I think that was a mistake. And he either didn't seem to care or didn't seem to understand that. And so my question would be, if, in fact, there is no systematic voter fraud, as he has said, then why do you need SB 3 or HB 1264 to essentially try to solve a problem that maybe isn't there? So he just seemed to have increasing difficulty navigating these very intensely political waters in a way that made many Democrats and some Republicans quite unhappy. And I think that's the root of the problem here. Whether he's personally apolitical or not, the environment has become increasingly complicated for him to navigate. And we haven't even talked about all the town clerk issues and weather-related issues and technology-related issues that have dogged him as well.
Listeners, give us a call if you'd like to weigh in. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Anna Brown, you want to
weigh in? Yeah, I just wanted to jump in, too. I feel that regardless of whether Van Ostern can rally the rest of the Democrats behind him or if Bill Gardner does maintain his seat, I think that Van Oster's campaign has certainly solidified. We know that SB 3 and HB 1264 are going to be facing changes in this upcoming legislature. It's clearly a priority. And I almost see that preliminary vote as more of a sign that Van Ostern's other priorities, and his organization was working on lots of voter registration and voter rights issues, that those are going to be priorities for legislators.
But you don't need to be sorry for the Johnny Carson reference, but Carnac the Magnificent to predict what's going to happen here after this election, which is Colin Van Ostern is right. Bill Gardner hasn't had a serious challenge since 1996. One thing's for sure, Colin Van Ostern, if he becomes Secretary of State, is going to have a serious challenge in 2 years, in 2020. And the Carnac part is this. For the last five elections, the House has flipped from one party to the other. So it's entirely possible, with the redistricting map that we now exist, Republicans will control the House in 2020. Would they vote to reelect Colin Van Ostern, Secretary of State, Colin Van Ostern, the Democratic nominee for governor, Colin Van Ostern, the former Democratic executive counselor, Colin Van Ostern, the former campaign manager for Congresswoman Annie Custer in her successful campaigns? No, they'll find a Republican they want for Secretary of State. So, isn't a criticism of Colin Van Ostern. It's just a reality that Dean was talking about is we're inexorably moving towards a Secretary of State office, potentially. That's very much like the Secretary of State office in every other state in the country,
elected,
right?
Yeah.
Where they're not even if they're not elected, they're political, they're partisan, and both parties try and outdo each other in order to throw the occupant out at the next election.
So it sounds like you're saying, Kevin, that when Bill Gardner says that you really shouldn't be spending $200,000 on staff and campaigns for this position, that he might have a point.
Well, I mean, sure. And it's easy for Bill Gardner to say that as the 42-year incumbent of the office. And Van Ostern will tell you, I needed to raise that money, particularly in order to – I mean, he spent – over a year campaigning and going all over the state at these meetings about Senate Bill 3 and about voter registration. How do we make it easier to vote? And you would talk with Bill Gardner, and he'd say, I haven't even begun making my calls. This is after the election. I haven't begun making my calls. I'm trying to do my job. I've got all these recounts. Well, that worked. For 40 years, that worked. But as we've seen in politics today, people like to get stroked. And no one was stroking the members for Bill Gardner, including, we should point out, over 130 that came into the House as House Democrats for the first time this week. They don't know this 40-year history. They don't know this man. All they know is for the last couple of years, there have been a lot of partisan fights about voter registration. And from the progressive point of view, Bill Gardner's been on the wrong team.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. In just a little bit, we're going to talk about the lawsuit filed by seven current and former Dartmouth students over what they say is the school's failure to protect students from a culture of sexual harassment assault. The number is 1-800-892-6477. If you'd like to comment on this, you can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Other stories we've been following this week, Conval Regional High School student involved in last week's school shooting threat at his school is being held in jail without bail. Last week, Anthony Wheeler allegedly posted a picture of two friends, also students at Conval, holding what appeared to be guns with the threat, "Don't go to school" on Wednesday. The schools were closed as a result. Wheeler, who is 18, is purportedly being charged with felony-level counts of criminal threatening. The two students pictured are under 18, so their identity has not been made public. Also this week, Nashua marked the second anniversary of its Safe Stations program with a ceremony. The program has helped thousands struggling with opioid use. Nashua was the second city to adopt Safe Stations in 2016, following Manchester's lead in opening fire stations 24/7 to those seeking help with addiction. New Hampshire is transitioning into a new model for addiction care across the state. It's going to be anchored by new walk-in hubs, many based in or located at hospitals. Safe Stations will remain open, but it's unclear how their role will change when the hubs open their doors in January. Also reporting by NHPR's Casey McDermott this week that lots of money leading up to last week's midterm elections was spent by independent expenditure campaigns. These are groups financed by an often difficult-to-track network of donors who spend big to shape voters' perceptions of the candidates and issues. So, Dean, I wanted to turn to you on this. Who benefited most this time around from these independent expenditure campaigns?
Towards the end of the race, in particular, Governor Sununu got about $844,000 from the Republican Governors Association in the last couple of weeks. A lot of that went towards advertising. Another about $175,000 from Granite PAC, which is a group of about 20 longtime Republican donors. On the Democratic side, the state legislature, Democratic candidates for state legislature got about $500,000 spread around from the New Hampshire Leadership Committee, which is the state arm of the Democratic Leadership Campaign Committee. So a fair bit of outside money. This has become how things are these days. Increasingly, outside groups. I think as long as campaign finance decisions from the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, consistently equate money with free speech, you're going to see more and more outside money pouring into these races. And the nature of digital technology and everything else has kind of nationalized the networks of activists, and so it's a lot easier to channel money into local races. A very different environment. I did some research on this back in conjunction with the 2000 presidential primary, and we were looking at is the New Hampshire primary environment ripe for outside spending? And at the time, the answer was not really, and it's just changed dramatically in the last 15 to 20 years. And I don't see that slowing down any time soon. It's not unusual now to spend for a big Senate race to spend or governor's race to spend $100 million all told.
Kevin.
Yeah, I was just going to say that we did a story before the election about the possibility of the leadership, the majority flipping in the legislature. And this was one of the things we looked at. In the nine targeted state Senate races, these independent groups were spending $400,000 all told. Now, this isn't an entirely new phenomenon in the legislature. In 2020, a lot of these same groups spent $500,000 to try and elect Democrats for state Senate seats. For example, the Every Town for Gun Safety group, Michael Bloomberg's super PAC supporting gun control, spent almost $200,000 to defeat a state senator, Republican from Nashua, Kevin Avard. The difference was in 2016, nobody noticed all this money spent. Why? Well, we had a presidential election. We had a very close U.S. Senate election. And the other reason nobody noticed, it didn't work. The Democrats lost. The Republicans kept a majority. And what Casey's story really very well documents the new wrinkle here, which was the cross-pollination of all these groups, all doing separate things in the past in silos, now finally working together. So you had a Democratic legislative candidate's phone bank organization reaching out to a Democratic canvassing organization saying, you need money? I've got more money. How about if I give you some money? How about if you give me some troops? So you were seeing this, and it became, and that's what became this army, which created, 580,000 people at the polls, because it wasn't just a lot of attack mail that got people riled up. It was phone calls. It was canvassing. It was rides to the polls. It was so well orchestrated and done by so many groups who are expert in their specific skill set.
Mm-hmm. And traditionally, the criticism for candidates had been that there's no coordination of the message, that basically candidates get concerned because they start to lose control of the message and the organization. What you're suggesting is now it's becoming more systematic and more coordinated.
Anna, do you agree with that, the sense that it's not simply the degree of outrage that turned people out at the polls? It was also just better organization?
I definitely think that's the case. And I also wanted to say, just to sort of help put it in context, it's very easy for us to throw out these big numbers, and it's hard to say where does that fall. So I just wanted to say that the total amount of independent spending in this election was more than either Sununu or Molly Kelly raised. So you can kind of think of it as a third gubernatorial candidate. It has a lot of power in the state. But I also don't want to underestimate how much people were supporting Democratic candidates regardless of this independent spending. If you look at those five Senate districts that flipped, Jeannie Deitch outraised Dan Hines 3-1. Shannon Chandley outraised Gary Daniels 3-1. Melanie Nevesque outraised Kevin Avar 2-1. John Morgan over Bill Gannon 2-1. Ton Sherman over Dan Innes 2-1. So it wasn't just the independent spending. You also saw a lot of support directly to the Democratic candidates themselves.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. We're speaking with Anna Brown of Citizens Count, Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader, and Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. And with you, we hope, give us a call if you have questions or comments about the week's news. Still to come after the break, we'll talk about that lawsuit filed by current and former students in Dartmouth's Psychological and Brain Sciences Department. They're suing over the way the school allegedly mishandled allegations of sexual assault and abuse. If you want to weigh in on this story, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
Every convention about how true crime stories usually unfold is upended.
That's why Bear Brook, the latest podcast from NHPR, has been downloaded more than a million times.
30 years ago this month, a mystery began.
It's the story of a decades-old cold case that's changing how murders will be investigated forever, reported by NHPR's own Jason Moon.
This story is not going to go the way you think it is.
Download it now or check it out at bearbrookpodcast.com.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader, Anna Brown of Citizens Count, and Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. And with you, give us a call if you have questions or comments about the week's news. We'll be talking about a variety of things lawsuit-related in this part of the show, including a couple filed by the ACLU of New Hampshire, one about the practice of emergency room boarding, another about an alleged illegal immigration stop. We're going to get to those. But first, we're going to talk about this lawsuit filed by seven current and former students in Dartmouth's Psychological and Brain Sciences Department. They're suing over allegations of alleged mishandling of sexual assault and harassment. Maybe we'll start with you, Anna. What are these students alleging?
Well, it's a broad range of complaints, all the way from, inappropriate sexual comments to rape. It's very serious allegations. There's several women. They argue that they also brought these allegations to the attention of administration and were asked to still continue working with these professors.
And that those professors at times got promotions.
Yes.
During the time.
And, yes.
And, interesting. If anybody wants to actually see the lawsuit, there's a link to it in NHPR's Brita Green story. You can find it at nhpr.org. What are these students sort of seeking as a remedy?
Well, I believe if I remember the number, it's $70 million in damages. So,
Dean, you're nodding along, so that's
Yeah, he's nodding along, yeah.
Absolutely right. $70 million is what they're asking for. And, you know, this involves these three professors. One, I think, was allowed to retire. The other two either resigned or were terminated from Dartmouth. They were all tenured faculty, I believe. I don't think they've been criminally charged. But this is getting a tremendous amount of national news attention. It was on the network Nightly News last night. I mean, it's certainly a public relations issue for Dartmouth.
Can you tell me why it's such a big story? I mean, is it a big story because it's Dartmouth, or because it's just the scope of what happened was egregious, or is it a combination of the two?
It's all of the above. I think certainly is part of it is Dartmouth. And, yep. You know, they had the predictable Animal House references many years ago. The model for Animal House was a frat at Dartmouth, the famous movie from the 70s. And so you always see these Animal House references. I saw that on the Nightly News. And so part of it is Dartmouth. You know, part of it is it sort of fit into the larger context of the Me Too movement. You know, part of it is the nature of the allegations. You know, I will say, having gone through a PhD program, you know, these particular women talked about these very difficult power dynamics. You know, you really are dependent on your advisors and your mentors, and they can really make or break your first career move once you graduate from the program. So there just was a lot at stake for them, and I think. And also, they're sort of a kind of a united. They're in pictures I've seen. They've identified themselves. It's kind of a united front as well. So I just think on multiple levels, it's an interesting story. And you know, Dartmouth has to kind of thread a needle here, where on the one hand they are acknowledging that they want to create an environment that is comfortable for men and women, but on the other hand they say that they're gonna defend themselves in the lawsuit. So they've got to kind of acknowledge the changing nature of academia in terms of these environments, but at the same time they're gonna want to defend against the $70 million claim.
So how has Dartmouth College responded so far?
They just responded to this essentially, as I said. But in general, they've had over the last several years, they've made changes. They've had you know, workshops, and just like in general, academia has responded to this by trying to do some self-examination and figure out if there's sufficient support for students, and to make sure that the climate is one that is conducive to learning. And so this has been a discussion that's been going on for a while now at universities, and actually this particular one, this issue, I think it's been a couple years or at least a year or so that this has been in the news.
So we're still waiting on exactly the criminal charges. Are they never going to be filed, or the AG is still looking in that
The
in
AG's
that direction?
Office is still looking at this charge. And a lot of this complaint really is going to be about the reference to the Me Too movement, the notion that Dartmouth College didn't necessarily cover up but moved too slowly on dealing with these folks. Last year, people will recall that Dartmouth had a very antiseptic process in terms of how they dealt with these very serious allegations. They hired an external investigator. They had kind of a secret investigation. They put these three professors, Todd Heatherton, Paul Whelan, and Bill Kelly, on paid leave. And then they were eventually forced out. Well, this suit basically takes the antiseptic out and describes, as they call it, an alcohol-soaked environment in the psychology department, where professional meetings were conducted in bars. Women were valued based on their physical attractiveness. Students faced retaliation if they failed to tolerate unwelcome sexual attention. After the complaints were raised, one of these women says that Whelan raped her after repeatedly serving her drinks. This is after they went to the administration with their allegations. So that's the liability Dartmouth College has right now. And that's why Dartmouth College response, at least to this point, was pretty strong. We respectfully but strongly disagree with the characterization of Dartmouth's actions in the complaint, and we'll respond through our own court filings. They're going to push back and say, you may not have known everything we were doing, behind closed doors to get these guys out the door quickly, but we were, and we'll prove it in court in this case.
Okay, so we're just going to have to wait for the follow-up court filings and the battle that's likely to occur there.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, let's talk about those two other cases that I mentioned regarding the ACLU, and we'll start with the one about emergency room boarding. The ACLU has sued the state over this practice. Anna Brown, what is emergency room boarding?
Sure. So there is a shortage of hospital beds at the state hospital and in other mental health hospitals in New Hampshire. So a lot of times what can happen is someone with a mental health emergency goes to the emergency room and they are involuntarily committed because they're considered a danger to themselves or others. And then they just have to wait for a bed to open up at the state hospital or one of these other quote-unquote receiving facilities. So the problem is, by state law, if you're going to involuntarily commit someone, you have to give them a hearing. But the way the law is written, it has to happen when they are at that facility where they're going to be staying, such as the state hospital. So when they're just in emergency rooms, they're basically in limbo. And this can go on for weeks.
Mm-hmm. And Gilles Bissonnette with the ACLU says that this process is denying these people a fundamental right.
And so what's happening is that these individuals are boarded in emergency rooms throughout the state of New Hampshire. And while they are in these emergency rooms, they're not receiving any form of due process.
And that's the crux of the issue, due process.
Absolutely. And so this is an issue that is definitely going to be coming up in the legislature, too, because Sununu and Senator Donna Susie, who is now the new president of the Senate, have both brought up mental health reforms as a priority in the upcoming budget. There was a pilot program that was launched with four hospitals to have video conference hearings for people in emergency rooms, but the program fell apart because the hospitals had concerns about security, liability, and staffing.
Mm-hmm. And so is this kind of lawsuit meant to bring justice to a particular person, or is it meant to put pressure on the legislature to do something about the larger issue that this happens because there aren't sufficient resources
in the
state?
Well, I think both, because absolutely. It was brought on behalf of a man who was in an emergency room in Nashua. This is affects real people's lives every single day. But obviously, it's in a much much bigger context of the dozens of people who are in emergency rooms for weeks on end. And, you know, the numbers vary from 40 to 100. It can be, you know, devastating for families who feel that their loved ones are just in limbo.
And it has been a busy week for the ACLU because they also filed a federal lawsuit against the Northwood Police Department for what they say was an illegal immigration stop based on racial profiling. So, Kevin, you're familiar with this one?
Yeah, there were three Hispanics in Northwood walking out of a gas station. And according to the ACLU's complaint, Northwood police identified them, asked about their immigration status. One of them made reference that explained that he gave officers a North Carolina driver's license, explained he was a DACA recipient. They continued to hold that individual for a couple hours while they contacted federal ICE agents to verify the immigration status. The suit basically says that that these officers had no probable cause to stop them in the first place, and the only reason they did was because of their race. And this is the second complaint lawsuit that ACLU has brought against a local police department in recent months.
Has that first one been resolved yet, or is that still in the works?
It has not. That is still in the works.
Yeah. Henry Clementowitz with the ACLU commented on this most recent instance that prompted this week's lawsuit.
The police can't stop you without probable cause, and in this case, it appears that that's what happened. They had no reason to believe that he was in the country illegally, and yet they stopped and held him for over 2 hours.
Clementowitz says it's reasonable to conclude that the reason they were stopped was because they were Hispanic. Dean?
It certainly seems like it. I mean, that would show that if that's the case, then obviously there wasn't any kind of probable cause. And, you know, the ACLU has been active on a number of fronts. We've talked before about the checkpoints, the border checkpoints in New Hampshire, enhanced border checkpoints, and whether or not people are being stopped for carrying drugs or other search and seizure issues. So this is, you know, part of the larger environment about the Trump administration's kind of stepped up immigration policies. And so, you know, this from what I've read about this particular story, it certainly seems like they saw these three guys and they went up to them and asked them for to identify themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And it also highlights out, too, a very divided law enforcement community. Yeah. As Dean knows, we've talked about this before at this table. There are certain local police and sheriff professionals who disagree with this policy and will not participate in helping and giving information to ICE. They refuse to conduct any kind of questioning of people just based on these folks may be here illegally. They won't do it. So, but there are other police chiefs who are pretty aggressive doing this in their communities because they feel it's a security issue sometimes.
Anna.
Well, also one of the interesting factors here is whether or not the local police department has been trained or authorized by the federal government to be cooperating with ICE. And one of the ACLU lawsuits that's pending does partly allege that they were detaining – this police department was detaining people on behalf of ICE and they were not trained and through this program to do so. And that also is – that program itself is controversial on the local law enforcement level because there comes in funding questions because the federal government will cover the cost of this training and certification to an extent, but you still have to cover the time for your officers. And then it's a question of, okay, are local police departments basically taking on a job that should be done by the federal government, which is immigration enforcement?
Mm-hmm. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. And coming up, Republican Ohio Governor John Kasich was in the state this week. He says he wouldn't rule out a bid for president as an independent. What do you think of that idea? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. And other stories we're reporting this week. Police are investigating the death of a woman last week at the Valley Street Jail in Manchester. 32-year-old Deatra Riley was found dead in her jail cell after an apparent suicide. Her mother, Lori Moore, says Riley struggled with addiction and depression and that she should have been getting better supervision. The jail says Riley was under detox watch at the time of her death, which requires checkups every 20 minutes. Valley Street Jail has been under scrutiny in recent months for treatment of inmates. Also, Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center is preparing to launch a new telemedicine unit focused on intensive care. Telemedicine is a growing trend in healthcare, and now Dartmouth-Hitchcock is hoping to use it to support intensive care units all over the region. Under this plan, intensive care specialists at Dartmouth-Hitchcock will connect with other doctors and nurses around the region to provide on-demand consultation. The program hopes to increase access to healthcare in rural areas by allowing more patients to be treated at local clinics. And one more story to discuss before the break is that a judge has ruled that New Hampshire authorities investigating the stabbing deaths of two women can examine recordings made by an Amazon Echo speaker with the Alexa voice assistant. Dean, what is this case all about?
Well, this is, as you mentioned, it's two women who were murdered in Farmington, and the issue revolves around this, as you mentioned, an Amazon Echo, which I believe is Alexa. You know, you talk to Alexa just like you might talk to Siri on your iPhone, and there's a thinking that the so-called wake-up words that activate this particular device could conceivably have been activated, and then that essentially they may have recorded some aspects of this, either the murder or something leading up to the murder. And the judge has ordered that Amazon produce recordings from, I think, January 27th through the 29th of 2017 to see what's on there. And this has been a bigger issue with these smart home devices and privacy issues. And, you know, what do they record and what kind of access should law enforcement have to those recordings? So it's this fits into a bigger debate about privacy and the nature of what happens to these. Because these devices, as I understand it, record everything you say, all the questions you ask, all of your searches. They may even have on occasion accidentally recorded other conversations. So it's an interesting larger debate, and this is just one part of it. You know, this could conceivably provide very important information for the individual who's been charged with murder here.
And Amazon's response was essentially, yeah, we'll give this information, but you need to make some kind of formal request. We're not just going to sort of give it out willy-nilly, which I don't know if that's comforting or the opposite of comforting. I mean, I don't have one of these things, so I don't.
Well, we've had these debates, too, about whether or not Apple will help unlock an iPhone that may have information that law enforcement wants. And so it's a very interesting and thorny set of privacy questions, raised by these smart devices.
Anna. Well, I think that the other thing that's important to remember, too, is in the case of a murder, we're all saying, yes, get the recordings.
Sure.
Absolutely. But the problem is, OK, once we set up this precedent that if you get a warrant, you can get recordings of this and
right.
you have no control over what was recorded. What else is this going to be used for? Is it going to be used for any crime? Would that be allowed? And so I think that we are entering sort of this information state where we are providing private information. It's not even that the government has to actively collect it. We're voluntarily giving it to companies. And the question is, where are the courts going to draw that line, which also I think it's going to be an interesting question in terms of the new constitutional amendment that just passed with the right to privacy. How is that going to factor into this?
How could the state step in and say, actually, no, we can't.
Right.
Yeah, we can't do this. Oh, so many lawsuits on the horizon,
so
I guess.
So many.
Well, hey, this is the Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We've got plenty more news to round up with you. If you have questions or comments about it, give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. We're going to be talking about GOP leadership in the next segment of the program. Also, the Budweiser Clydesdale training facility at the Anheuser-Busch Brewery in Merrimack is being relocated. What do you think about that? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader, and Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis at Citizens Count, which is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization committed to encouraging civic engagement by providing objective information. Let's start this part of the program by talking about a cold case. New Hampshire's cold case unit announced Wednesday that Elizabeth Lamott, who went missing from Manchester in 1984 at the age of 17, has been matched to previously unidentified remains discovered in Tennessee in 1985. Anna, how was this done?
Sure. So this all goes back to a new law enforcement technique, which is using genealogy databases to find distant relatives of victims or criminals and connect them by putting together these vast family trees. So we saw this used for the Bear Brook case, where unfortunately the victims are still unidentified, but they were able to identify the killer, and also the Golden State Killer case in California. So this is tricky because at this point, people who are giving their DNA to genealogy databases, although they may be all in favor of having their DNA used to identify distant relatives who may be involved in a crime or unidentified, that's certainly not why people are putting this information into databases. And so the reason why law enforcement also did not need warrants to do this is because they were primarily using a database where people voluntarily uploaded their DNA information that they had gotten from other companies such as 23andMe and said anybody can look at this and compare and put together family trees. So at this point, it's sort of a question of just because someone has made this publicly available, does this mean that anyone, including law enforcement, can use it however they want? And it's once again one of these landscapes where it's a very new frontier of privacy of information. And there's that question of just because someone has theoretically given it to a private company, does that mean that it can be used for any purpose?
Some really thorny issues there. Worth mentioning, too, that on Monday we're going to be talking about the Bear Brook murders with NHPR's Jason Moon, the host of the Bear Brook podcast from NHPR. We'll talk about the case. We'll hear about Jason's reporting process. And we'll also look at the role genealogy plays in solving crimes. So that's Monday at 9 a.m. on the Exchange, conversation with NHPR's Jason Moon about this very issue. Fascinating. Dean, do you want to weigh in on this?
No, I mean, it's been fascinating to me the extent to which this has captivated people's interest, and it is really a new frontier for how you use genetic information and DNA, and it's had a huge in general. This whole field has had a huge impact on solving all sorts of crimes, of exonerating people, and it's pretty remarkable to see their ability to unpack these really old cases.
Kevin,
this is true crime stuff. I mean, forensic files, whatever you want to call it. We didn't even know about this woman until 2017. And the only reason we knew was because of the Bear Brook murders cold case story was reported. There was a big press conference. And this tip comes in about this woman who ran away from YDC, which is what used to be the Youth Development Center. It's now the Sununu Center for Troubled Juveniles. When she was 17, the tipster thought she might be related to the person who's been identified as the Bear Brook murderer, Terry Petter Rasmussen. At one point, there was this working theory she might have actually been his young bride back in the mid-1980s. Well, the DNA testing they found two brothers who of this Elizabeth Lamont, who had gone missing in 84, and that's that matched the remains of this woman who actually died in 1985, which certainly brings closure to her and a precedent-setting case for folks in Tennessee. But it does point out, as Anna said, that just the level of science is incredible today.
Yeah. Are we going to reach that place where basically there can be a complete record of where everyone has been at any moment? And at what point will we reach a critical mass of people uploading their DNA information to these genealogy websites that you can identify anyone? I mean, in some ways it's good because obviously catching these serial killers is amazing. It's wonderful. After so these cold cases have been going on for decades. But on the other hand, you do wonder what else could it be used for? And could it be used by private companies and not just the government?
Mm-hmm. More stories to discuss this morning. We'll get to them in a moment, but want to take, first of all, a question from JR on Facebook, since we mentioned those constitutional amendments just a little while ago. JR wrote in to ask, when did the recently passed state constitutional amendments go into effect? Was it immediate? Was it January 1st? Do you know, Anna?
You know what? I actually don't know. I'm going to have to look that up.
I don't know whether it's the January 1st or immediately. I'm not sure.
Listen, yeah, usually they do take effect on January 1st. Anything that deals with privacy matters, most statutes spell out a January 1st beginning.
Okay. Thank you for the answer, Kevin. Really appreciate it. And let's also take a call from Barbara in Henniker. Barbara, thanks very much for giving us a call.
Good morning, everybody. I'm sorry I'm late in relation to the issue, but I want you to know, as far as I'm concerned, it's a broader issue than just not having enough beds in a hospital.
And you're referring to the emergency boarding issue that the ACLU is suing over?
Yes. Yeah. In any event, it's a broader issue than just not having enough beds. We need a lot of these people. If they had care before, when their episode was first starting, they would not even have to go into the hospital. So I really think we need to look at the total picture. I know it's not good that they end up in the hospital, and sometimes for days. That's terrible. But the issue is that we need to make sure that the clinics that we have around the state are adequately staffed, et cetera, and that these people get the treatment they need before. Now, you can't keep everybody out of the hospital. I realize that. But you can keep a lot of these people out if they have adequate care beforehand. And let's face it, it's a money issue.
Yeah.
We had, as a result of a lawsuit, this is a number of years ago, we had a fantastic mental health system. People from all over the country used to come and look and see what we were doing. And as we gradually underfunded, we lost the system. And here we are again.
Well, Barbara, thank you very much. I appreciate your call. So Barbara's saying, you know, with respect to the emergency room boarding issue that the ACLU is suing over, there's more of a response needed, not just adding more beds. Anna, does that resonate with you?
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, and there was, so she's talking about a lawsuit that was a few decades ago, but also there was an even more recent lawsuit within the last decade, which required more funding for mobile crisis response teams and the various community health, mental health centers around the state. Another issue that we did not even touch on is the lack of a secure psychiatric hospital in New Hampshire. The ACLU and other organizations, Rennie Cushing, who was running for House Speaker, have brought up the fact that New Hampshire really should not be putting any patients in prison, and the secure psychiatric unit in New Hampshire is located at the state prison. So there is a whole host of funding and reform issues related to this that I think are going to be addressed in next year's budget.
Other stories that NHPR has been following this week, New Hampshire's largest solar company wants to train more electricians to fill jobs in renewable energy and other industries. Revision Energy is touting its new training center as part of National Apprenticeship Week, but the program already has 50 students enrolled, and for the next 4 years, they'll earn full-time wages and enough training hours to get their state electrician certification. Also, James Foley, a reporter who was killed by ISIS militants in 2014, was recognized by the New Hampshire Supreme Court Society during a ceremony this week. Foley grew up in Wolfboro. He was covering the Syrian civil war when he was captured and killed by ISIS. His death brought attention to the dangers facing journalists, and Foley's parents were on hand to accept the award. The family launched a foundation in James Foley's honor with a focus on the return of American hostages and the support of journalists in conflict zones. And also this week, worth mentioning that John Kasich, Ohio Governor John Kasich, was here in New Hampshire. Anna, you were there when he spoke.
Yes.
What was your impression of his visit?
Yeah, so that was at the Inaki S. Loeb School of Communications First Amendment Awards last night. And so he gave a little speech, and then he also did sort of a mini town hall. And the audience was asked not to ask him if he was going to run or not. But, you know, we still sort of danced around the issue. And he was very critical of Trump. He's very vocal about that. He criticizes Trump for being divisive, for playing the blame game. And he's clearly open to running again. It's unclear if he would run as an independent, if he would run as a Republican. And I don't think he's fully decided yet. But I did take the opportunity to ask him if he thought any third party or independent challenge could succeed on the national level. And he said, you know, it's maybe. Look at how far technology has come. I'd say anything is possible. But he did say that he believes most people are soft Democrats or soft Republicans. So maybe that seems more like he's going to run as a Republican challenger.
Dean, what do you think?
Yeah, the problem is he's facing a bit of a structural challenge here. You know, Donald Trump has moved very quickly over the last 2 years to remake the Republican Party in his image. A number of the Republicans who were defeated in this past midterm in the U.S. House of Representatives were a bit more moderate. And so the folks who were still left in Congress who are Republicans are more like Trump. They support his agenda. They're more comfortable with his temperament and leadership style. And Trump still has very high approval among Republicans. So you think about a path that Kasich might have to the Republican nomination. It's very challenging. It's kind of, you know, kind of the Northeast and the West Coast and maybe a couple of Midwestern states. But it would be a real challenge for him to compete in a Republican primary situation where Trump still has a great deal of support. And not surprisingly, I've heard him talk increasingly about an independent bid. That has its own challenges. You know, the system is really stacked against independent bids because the two parties control, the process for the most part. They get to set the rules of the game. And so getting an independent candidate on the ballot in every state is a big challenge in terms of money and resources. So he's in a difficult position. As Anna said, he's increasingly vocal and outspoken in his criticism of Trump. It used to be a little bit more muted, not so much anymore. I don't think he's made a final decision. You know, my sense from talking to people is that they realize that it's a bit of an uphill battle. They want to have somebody who is a spokesman or for those Republicans who oppose Trump. New Hampshire would be a great place to do this if he's going to try to do it. He really bought into the whole New Hampshire primary retail politics ethos the last time he was here. You could see him change over the course of the primary. So if he's going to do anything, he'll probably start it here. But there just are tremendous impediments to him actually pulling this off.
Kevin?
Yeah, all good points, Dean. I think here's President Trump's problem, right? I think Kasich is a long shot to win the Republican presidential nomination in 2020. But what he can succeed to do is prevent Trump from winning a second term in 2020. I mean, ask President George H. Bush how that worked out for him in 1992 when Pat Buchanan from the right launched this quixotic challenge of a sitting president on conservative principles on many of the same issues Donald Trump talks about today. Pat Buchanan got 40% in New Hampshire. He couldn't win the nomination. Bush will tell you it divided the Republican Party dramatically and led to Ross Perot running as an independent and then led to Bill Clinton defeating a sitting president in 92. That's what Trump really has to worry about with Kasich. If he's serious about mounting a primary challenge, he could make it harder for Trump to unite his party, which any incumbent president needs to have happen, because then you can use the powers of the incumbency against the other party's
Kevin,
nominee.
The question I would ask you is, I mean, we've all interacted with Kasich. Do you think he would be happy being a spoiler, or he's only going to get in if he thinks he can win?
Yeah, no, I don't think he would be. I really don't. He finished second in New Hampshire and felt he never peaked at the right time, that Trump outpeaked him. He certainly, you remember Clinton and what he made out of a second-place showing in New Hampshire, right? And the first time in 92. And Kasich wasn't able to do that. No, I think Kasich, as he says, I have a burning desire to make a difference. Being a spoiler is not making a difference. So that may be why this independent bid, while it couldn't, it's an even harder, I agree with Dean, it's an even harder path to the presidency. It would give him a platform during the entire presidential campaign.
Well, I think the other thing that would be really interesting to see is we talked at the beginning of the program about independent spending, and that often is very, you know, entrenched in either Democrat or Republican. I think maybe an independent run could have a chance if you saw that, you know, independent spending and dark money and PACs really get behind an independent candidate, and I don't know if that would happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll wrap up the show with one last story that I think only you, Kevin, can comment on, which is that the Budweiser Clydesdale training facility at the Anheuser-Busch Brewery in Merrimack is being relocated to Missouri. Company officials stress, though, that the horses will remain at the local stables when they're. So you've seen these horses, Kevin?
I have. They're amazing physical creatures. I mean, the Clydesdales are all over 6 feet tall. They all weigh roughly a ton. They're so well trained. I mean, you can be intimidated by their size and their mammoth girth, but they're so docile because they are so well trained. And it's great they're going to continue to be housed in Merrimack when they're not touring. But they're like the Rockettes. The Clydesdales travel everywhere, and they're very well experienced, the people who run them. So they're going to be on the road a lot. So they'll be missed in Merrimack when they're away.
All right. Well, Kevin Landrigan, thank you very much for your comments today.
Thank you.
And also I want to thank Anna Brown and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences. Anna Brown from Citizens Count. Really appreciate you being here as well.
It was wonderful.
Thanks, Peter.
All right. And this conversation continues online on Facebook at nhpr.org. You can find links to all the stories we've discussed today. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening. The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.